good evening. Thank you and welcome to joining me, your host, Kurt Dillon, tonight for this, the first inaugural episode of Just Gone, our specialized podcast that is dedicated specifically to active unsolved missing persons cases around the country and around the world occasionally. With me tonight, I have our fantastic co-host, Danny Lott. I also have April Hill. I have Ellie Sherrill. I have Matt Sloniker. We have Jennifer Falk. We have our resident coroner, Dakota Bloyd. And we have Steph Clark. I want to thank everybody on the panel for joining me tonight for this. I know we have a big subset of fans out there that love these unsolved mystery disappearing act cases that don't fit with the format that we have for the regular The Veritas 7 True Crime Podcast. So I decided we were going to make this sister podcast specifically for you folks that love these active unsolved cases. Tonight, we go over the still incredible disappearance of Tammy Lynn Leppert. For those of you who don't know, Tammy Lynn was an 18-year-old girl who was an up-and-coming starlet. She had started enrolling in beauty pageants from the time she was four, and believe it or not, she had won a ridiculous 280 of the 300 beauty pageants that she joined between the ages of 4 and the ages of 16. She came out the winner in 280 out of the 300, which is, I mean, that's pretty, I don't know of anybody else in the beauty pageant ticket that ever racked up a thing like that. About any of you ladies that follow the beauty queens and the beauty pageants, you ever hear of a success rate like that before?
I have not. That's definitely impressive.
Yeah, really. I just crazy. So, I mean, obviously, all anybody's got to do is Google it, look at a picture of her. We have a ton of pictures of her on our website that you can go and look. Very beautiful girl. Some would say an exceptionally beautiful girl. She had a supporting non-credited role in the 1983 pop movie Spring Break, which is basically one of those, teen sex procedural movies that they had back then that were real popular in the early 80s. Spring Break, she played a boxer, so she had a little role in that. And perhaps better known for her role as the distracting blonde in the movie Scarface. If you remember when the hitman was sitting out there in the convertible, it was actually Tammy who was her job to go over in her very skimpy blue bathing suit, bikini, and entice him and distract him from seeing what was going on while the chainsaw murder was happening and that scene of Scarface in the movie. So she's probably a little bit better known for that one than she was for Spring Break, but both of them were good roles and they were promising. She was only 18 years old when she disappeared. She had a really promising career. And we're going to get into all the nuances and the idiosyncrasies of that here now. So with that being said, let's take a look at, she had, right after they got finished filming Spring Break, Tammy Lynn went to a party, one of those infamous Hollywood parties where, you know, everybody who's anybody is there. And there was a lot of stuff going on. As you can imagine, there was a lot of illegal behind the scenes stuff going on. According to the people in her family and her friends, when Tammy Lynn came back from that party, she was never the same again. They all believe wholeheartedly that something happened, that she witnessed something, experienced something, something was done to her, she was threatened, whatever the details of it may be, they're under scrutiny, and they're widely debated. In every, you know, we'll take a simple Google search on her name, Tammy Lynn Leppert, and you'll see any one of 100 different theories about what happened, who did it, how it played out, and the like. But what's certain is that her personality underwent a change after she attended that party. And it only seemed to escalate in the weeks and months after that. To the point, so much so, she landed the role, that iconic role in Scarface, where it was her job to distract the lookout man. But 4 days into shooting, there was a scene that she was just witnessing. She wasn't even in the scene, but she had to witness a scene where somebody was getting shot and there was supposed to be fake blood spurting, you know, arterial blood spurting after the fake gunshot. When that played out in the movie, Tammy lost it. She had a complete breakdown there behind the scenes on the set. She had to be taken off. She had to be sedated. She had to be brought to, her mother brought her to a psychiatric hospital and checked her in Florida. People who don't live in Florida might not know, Florida is one of the few states they have what they call the Baker Act laws. Baker Act laws in Florida means that if you're exhibiting strange behavior that might lead any normal rational person to believe that you could be a danger to yourself or to anybody else, anybody that sees that behavior can take you to a mental hospital or call the police, and the police can then commit you to the care of a psychiatric center for 72-hour evaluation. And after the terms of 72 hours, they either deem that you need more care or treatment or that you're good to go and they let you go. If they deem you need more care or treatment, they keep you for up to 30 days, which after 30 days, then they have to go to court to try and keep you against your will. Where if they find out that you're okay, obviously the Baker Act is over, the restraint on you is lifted, and you can leave at your own will. So her parents basically Baker Acted her after the meltdown on the set of Scarface, and she was never, it only got increasingly worse after that. Every bout and every spat that she had just got a little bit worse, a little bit worse, a little bit worse, until finally on July the 1st of 1983, when she accidentally locked herself out of her house, took a baseball bat and busted out the windows in the lower level of the house to get back in. So she really, at that point, was losing it. Again, after that incident, her mother took her and Baker Acted her again. She spent another 72 hours under psychiatric care until the 4th, when she was released. They determined that she wasn't a danger to herself or anybody else. So on July the 4th, she was released from psychiatric observation and free to go about her business. On the 6th of July, just 2 days later, is when she arranged to get in the car and go take a trip with her longtime friend. And they got into an argument shortly into the trip. She wanted to go in one direction. He wanted to go in another direction. She demanded, like so many women of that era did, you know, let me out right here. I don't want to be in the car with you anymore. I don't want to look at you. I don't. That was a big thing in the 80s. I don't know if I'm dating myself a little bit, but I remember, you know, that was the thing. That was the rage in the 80s, was for the woman to say, you let me out of this car right now. She pulled the let me out of this car right now, and he did. He complied, and he pulled her up, which, by the way, was a no-no even back then. Despite how adamant the girl was that she wanted to get out of the car, you don't leave the girl on the side of the road. So just as to all of you out there, the guy, young men and older men or whatever, when the wife or the girlfriend or the mother or the whatever it is, when the woman says, stop this car and let me out right now. Yeah, don't do it. Don't. Because very rarely does it end well for you, for them, for anybody involved. So just, you know, take them to the nearest place where it's safe and drop them off. And if it's a kind of thing where it's like a domestic violence kind of thing and she's starting to freak out, offer to take her to the police station, a hospital, whatever the case may be. But under no circumstances do you ever pull over on the side of the road and let a woman off on the side of the road by herself with nobody else. You just don't ever do that. You don't do it in a parking lot. You don't do it in a bank. You don't do it anywhere unless there's people around. So just news for the wise out there. So anyway, he complies. He lets her out at the glass bank there in Southern Florida. She gets out of the car. We actually have a photo that's going to be on our website of her on the last day, right before she disappeared, that was taken from surveillance video of the bank, where she's wearing the denim shirt and she's wearing the skirt. She doesn't have any purse. There have been reports that were read that she actually had a gray purse and she was wearing sandals or whatever the case may be. The photo is very clear. She has no shoes on. She does not have a purse. So she's walking around with no money. She has no, and she's barefoot and she's in a parking lot. So we actually have the photo of that. That's going to be on our website. She went then and she walked. We know she walked down the street to an Exxon gas station from the glass bank. It was pretty close. She made three relatively excited, borderline frantic telephone calls to her aunt about needing a ride and that she was riding in the car with basically was a jerk and left her and all this other kind of stuff. She made three phone calls to the aunt, and then she was never seen or heard from again. So now we're going to delve into the possibilities, the details that we know, the things that we don't know, and speculate on, and so forth. And I know that my co-host, Danny Lott, has done a lot of research on this, so I'm going to turn it over to her to let you fill you in on the background and what she found out. Danny, go ahead, take it away.
So this is about Christopher Wilder, you know, the Australian serial killer. He was known to be responsible for the abduction and rape of at least, you know, 12 women and murdered at least 8 women in the early 80s. So he actually knew Tammy, said that he wanted for her to model for him and everything. And
yeah, I remember reading that.
So, but here's the thing is that his spree didn't start until after Tammy, about a year after.
Okay. So he wasn't a serial killer yet at that point.
Right. Okay. But, you know, I mean, could what he did to Tammy, if he did something, like, could that have sparked him? Maybe once he saw that they weren't going to find her, he thought he could get away with it. And so that's when he really started his spree.
It's possible. He had a family in Australia before he came over here, right?
Yes.
So but for all intents and purposes, at least what we know, he lived a pretty ordinary life, you know, up until that point, and until a little while after he came to America. And it is kind of weird. While it's not unheard of for people to become serial killers in their 30s and 40s, they usually don't lead a seemingly normal life up to that point. There's usually, when people go back and look at the pathology, you usually find, you know, they abused little animals and they tortured things and they did all kinds of heinous things that nobody put together as escalating steps, if you will, throughout their early life. But by all accounts, I couldn't find anything bad about this guy before. I think, what was he, 28 when he started his spree, something like that?
But I do have some information that a psychologist actually did deem him unsafe because he had a need to dominate women.
Okay.
In 1977. So that was several years before everything happened.
Oh, and so he was exhibiting some of the signs. Okay.
So
we're talking about Wilder, right?
That, yeah.
Yes. But he actually did have sexual misconduct charges on him. He just didn't have any, you know, killings or anything like that.
Right, right. I remember reading that now. He was actually charged with sexual misconduct in Australia, and he got permission to come to America, and he just never went back.
Yeah.
They think in 1965, he may have been responsible for two murders of girls. In Sydney.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I'm trying to figure out when he got here. Do you know when he got here?
I have it on here somewhere. Hang on. This is all the people he killed.
1969 he came here. So he had issues in Australia in 63 and he came here in 69 and his spree that they know of started February of 84. And this,
yeah, so he must have come right before 1970, because in November in Australia he used nude photographs to extort sex from an Australian student nurse, and when she complained to police, the charges were dropped when she refused to testify, and that was still in Australia in November.
Yeah, it says here, so it says here that he was married in Australia in 68 at the age of 23. He became an American citizen in 69. and he settled in southern Florida. But he kept, at that point, he was traveling back and forth between Florida and Australia. Now it says in 71 was that incident in Pompano Beach where he was soliciting the woman to take nude photographs. And he pled guilty to disturbing the peace in that case. So he didn't get any sexual assault rap. He just disturbing the peace. And then he was first documented, his first documented sexual assault in the U.S. happened in 1976 when a family had hired him to work on their home in Boca Raton. And their 16-year-old daughter, he decided to victimize their 16-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did is he told her, he gave her a scam that she could work for him as in his company, and he lured her to his truck. The girl at 16 had the foresight to tell him she had a venereal disease because she knew that he was going to try and rape her. He didn't care. He raped her anyway.
Yeah.
And People Magazine... People at Magazine actually wrote an article on that called Journey of Terror. The second incident, they said, occurred in 1979 in Palm Beach, charged with the attempted rape of a 17-year-old that he introduced as David Pierce. He said he was an agent for a modeling school, and he pled out to lesser charges. Then in 83, he returned to Australia to visit his parents, and that's when he's accused of killing the two girls, Marianne Schmidt and Christine Sherrick.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he tortured and murdered both of them at Wanda Beach in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, this guy went everywhere. I'm reading this right now. So on March 21st, there was a 23-year-old nursing student at Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas, where I'm from, oddly enough.
Wow.
Most of my friends graduated from Lamar. So she turned down to pose as a model for him. And then after that, he abducted and raped her. And then he stabbed her to death and dumped her body in a canal. And she was found on March 26th. And then after he killed her, he took her car and abducted another woman in Oklahoma City. And then when he abducted her, he took her to Newton, Kansas, 180 miles away, checked into a motel, and then they had breakfast the next morning. I mean, the audacity. They had breakfast the next morning, and then he drove to Milford Reservoir, which is 90 miles northeast of Newton, where he then stabbed her to death and dumped her body under a cedar tree. I mean, this guy went everywhere.
Wow, that's crazy. But even before all of that, apparently when he was accused of killing the two girls, Sherrick and the other one, he was charged. He bonded out in Australia. He paid bond, $350,000 bond. And he asked the court for permission to leave the country and come to America. And they said, okay.
I know. It's crazy.
Like, how does that happen? I mean,
yeah. This guy was loaded. It says at the time of his death, he had $7 million.
Yeah, he had a successful real estate business.
Yeah. This is wild. I'm sitting here looking at this and I'm like, you're accused of killing two girls. They give you a $350,000 bail. You post it, ask them if you can leave the country. And they say, okay. Yeah, it's all right.
And then what I find weird about this is that Tammy's mom knew him too, but then after he died, she ended up suing the estate for her death and then for Tammy's death. And then she took it back. And she said that she never believed that he had anything to do with it in the first place. So I just find that so weird.
This isn't, yeah. Well, her mother was clearly, we have a picture that's going to be on the website right before her mother passed. She actually took a photo of herself laying in a casket, holding a picture of Tammy, saying that her dying wish was to know.
Yes, I did hear that her dying wish was to know.
I mean, that's, these people weren't exactly, you know, they were a few French fries short of a happy meal. Most of the people in this group, the elevator wasn't going to the top floor.
So did I hear Danny say that Tammy's mother knew Christopher Wilder?
Yes.
And that's documented.
Yes. The matter of fact, the police report that we have the heading of here, his name is blocked out. They whited it out because he wasn't officially charged with the crime. But most sources believe that the person that's referring to in the complaint, in the missing persons complaint, that her mother swore. Then her mother actually sued him for $6 million. For negligence and abuse and anguish, and also for Tammy's funeral expenses, even though there was no body. She actually filed a lawsuit against Wilder for $6 million.
And then she took it all back.
And then she dropped it. Just as quick as she started, she dropped. So, I mean, it looks to me, as a forensic psychologist, it looks to me like there is a history of mental illness in this family.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean? I don't think it's usually hereditary. There are definitely genetic and hereditary markers in mental illness and mental hygiene, or the lack thereof. And it's absolutely true that Tammy had episodes where she acted out, where she got irrational, where she got violent, where she looked like she could have been a threat to herself or to other people, and so forth. But clearly, there's a history in the family, because the things her mother does is not rational either.
Right. It's so weird. I don't understand.
There are people, too, that argued that it wasn't schizophrenia that she was suffering from, that she didn't have a psychotic break, and it wasn't schizophrenia that Tammy was suffering from, but actually PTSD. Which is post-traumatic stress disorder.
I was just going to say, you know, after she saw what she saw on the set that made her change, you know, how could that relate to Christopher in any way? Was there any chance he could have been on that set? Because after that, she would not drink from open bottles. Like, she was very scared that she was going to be drugged. She wouldn't drink from open bottles. You know, she wouldn't eat unpackaged food.
Right. Yeah, I read all of that, too. Clearly, there was an escalation going on. I'm just saying the bizarre behavior actually started before that. The bizarre behavior started after she went to that party, right after the wrapping of spring break. So that's when it started. It didn't really start manifesting itself to the point where anybody looking at her would see aberrant behavior until the breakdown at Scarface.
Yeah.
That was the first episode where people were like, you know, oh my God, this girl's going to snap. Or she did snap when she saw that gunshot scene. Now, there's a lot of speculation about what she saw, what she could have saw, what happened, and whatever the case may be. The only way, really, that you could look at this and you could say that this was... that she saw somebody get murdered, she saw somebody get raped or whatever. There has to be, it's not like, real life is not like the movies. Even in Hollywood, real life is not like the movies. There was no body. Nobody was found dead at that scene. So she might have seen some drug dealing going on. She might have seen some crazy stuff. But for her to see like a killing or like a mutilation or like something that would send her over the edge like that, to make her think that somebody was going to kill her, to make her think that she, you know, to change her life forever. I don't see it. I don't see where it could be something like that, because people speculate that, you know, she really didn't disappear. I read on Reddit, believe it or not, on some of the comments where people posed this theory that she had actually asked him to drop her off there at the bank because the cops were waiting to pick her up and whisk her away into the witness protection program. Then why would she go to the Exxon and call her aunt? If she was going into witness protection, the theories, a lot of the theories just don't make sense with the facts that we know. I'm not saying she didn't see anything horrible at that party. She absolutely might have seen somebody get raped. She absolutely might have seen somebody OD on drugs and like something, have a bad trip or something, you know, because back then in time frame in the 80s, acid was a big thing. In the early 80s, acid made a big comeback. PCP and all of that, people were dropping acid. They were lacing marijuana cigarette, you know, joints dipping them in PCP or whatever and smoking them and then having trips or whatever. And some people had bad trips. And
it's definitely possible.
Well, and it's very possible that that's what happened. She might have, there were reports that she had smoked marijuana numerous times early in her life. It is very possible that somebody gave her a laced joint at that party and she had a bad trip and just never recovered from it.
Yeah. Maybe she thought she saw something.
Yeah. You know what I mean? For the simple fact that, like I said, if somebody died, if somebody was raped and murdered and brutalized and she witnessed it and whatever the case may be, there would be some evidence of that. Somebody that was at that party would have come up missing at least. Even if they weren't declared dead, somebody went to the last place they would have been known to be is that party. And then just they're not around anymore.
Right.
And it wasn't like that. You know, I mean, keep in mind, we're not talking about a barn burner party where, you know, it's all like homeless people are showing up or whatever. This is a Hollywood Hills, everybody's a millionaire kind of thing. Nondescript people don't go to those parties. So anybody that's at a place like that, at a party like that, they're going to be missed if they just stop showing up.
Right. With the whole blind items thing, I mean, it's definitely, you know, I could see, I mean, the party did take place in Florida.
Right.
And, you know, he wasn't, Paul wasn't a very big actor at the time. Obviously, you know, that's why the theory is that he was selling drugs to help pay his bills and everything. Right. And he didn't do a lot of acting after that. But I just feel like it's not impossible for a guy to have, you know, wanted in on the area that he had, right, especially there in Florida. You know, he could have been some random, you know, my thing is that I just don't believe that Paul and her only had a one night stand like he claimed.
Right. No, yeah, I mean, it's very possible.
She was such a beautiful girl. Yeah, she was such a beautiful girl.
She was gorgeous. You know, we have on our website, too, the cover poster for the movie Spring Break. Most people believe that that's her body in the picture.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, she had a very beautiful face. She had a very beautiful... She was a gorgeous girl. She was a gorgeous girl. And unfortunately, I've talked about in previous the Veritas 7 podcast episodes for other cases... unfortunately, when you have mental issues like that, it's very easy to be branded as a victim. And it's very possible that she just encountered the wrong person that day. It's very possible that she wandered out in the middle of the street and somebody picked her up. She didn't necessarily have to be hitchhiking. She didn't necessarily have to be what, I mean, it's Florida. There's traffic, there's cars everywhere. And you also have unsavory people everywhere. The wrong person could have been just driving down the street, saw a girl dazed on her feet, walking around not steady, barefoot, in the middle of the road, in a parking lot, no purse, whatever they get, clearly in some kind of distress, and just decided, I got me one.
Right. I totally agree. And, you know, it's also possible that her mental issues and what she saw at the party has absolutely nothing to do with why she disappeared. And maybe it was Christopher Wilder. I mean, he was in the area at the time, as was another killer.
That's right. Yeah. And that's the thing with most of these cases, when we look at them, is there are so many scenarios that are plausible. They don't have to be likely, but they're plausible. And as long as you can't disclude them or eliminate them with the factual evidence that's out there, this is why these cases don't get solved. You can't narrow down the possibilities. If you can't narrow down the possibilities, you could never make a case against anybody. Particularly when you don't have a body and you don't have DNA and you don't have trace evidence and you don't have fingerprints and you don't have tire marks and you don't have any of the traditional methods that law enforcement agencies use to solve these crimes. You have none of it.
Exactly. And, you know, it's very weird to me that even though they, you know, law enforcement obviously knew that Tammy and her mother both knew Christopher Wilder and were involved with him for modeling or whatever, that they didn't look into him more for it. But, you know, I guess he died not that long after her, you know, disappearance. Right. he died in a shootout in New Hampshire with the police.
Right.
In 1984. So, right. You know, maybe if he had lived longer, they could have gotten some answers from that. Who knows?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's very possible the secret might have died with him. They even speculate that just at a happenstance, he just so happened to be driving by and he recognized her and saw her there at the glass bank or at the Exxon, and that Wilder's the one that picked her up. Not that she called him, but just, and it's really funny. I've not been able to find that the police went and pulled the phone logs from that phone.
She knew him. She very well could have called him.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I mean, we don't know because nobody, again, here we have bad investigation. Why would you not pull the call logs? We know she called the aunt because the aunt's got the voicemail messages or the answer machine messages. But I mean, one common sense just tell you, let's see if she called anybody else while she was there, especially since she didn't get the aunt.
Right. Yeah, I definitely have my theories about Christopher Wilder. He just seems, you know, to be the most involved.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I mean, there's no putting it past him. The guy was a scumbag. There's no two ways about it. You know, he was human detritus. So, I mean, it's not like he's incapable of it or we're putting anything on him that's out of character. This is right up his lane.
Well, one thing you guys haven't really touched on is with Wilder, the girls he was going after and targeting were all models and runner-ups and beauty pageants. One of his girlfriends was the runner-up to Miss Florida. He targeted, you know, these beauty queen girls, and she fit that mold perfectly.
Yeah, oh yeah, that was his thing. Exactly. Yeah, no doubt. Oh, yeah, she fit right in his wheelhouse. So, yeah, absolutely. And unlike most serial killers, this guy was different in the way that, and I noticed nobody mentioned this. Nobody keyed off on this, and nobody would ever, and maybe it's just my twisted, warped mind because I do, you know, like fiction and serial killers, and I've been studying them pretty much my whole adult life, and even before my adult life, actually. But nobody picked up on the fact that he's really the only serial killer that developed relationships with his victims and like dated them before killing them.
Right.
Sometimes for extended periods of time. Usually a serial killer picks up a chick, may take her out to dinner or whatever, woo her, get her into a compromised position, and wham, he's on her like white on rice. Not this guy. This guy was all about the long game. He's like, I not only want your body, I want your mind too. So it's he manipulated these girls into dating him, maybe having feelings for him or relationships with him or whatever. And then all of a sudden, one day, wham, here's the knife.
Yep. Which that's, and all over the country.
Yeah. And that's and not all over the world. Forget. I mean, he did it in Australia, too. That's different to me. So that's something going forward with this case. If I was an investigator working this case, I would absolutely look at that angle. I don't think you can rule that out because it really says a lot about his mental condition. He was not in any rush to kill these women.
Yeah.
He wanted to dominate them. He wanted to possess them.
Right. Another thing that, you know, I'm not sure if they looked into is that he really seemed to take his victims across state lines a lot. Did they go across state lines and look for her? Because, you know, there was an unidentified woman's body was found in New York in 1979, and she remained a Jane Doe until 2015, where then they found out that she was Tammy Jo Alexander, who had vanished from Brooksville, Florida.
Right.
So yeah, I think there's a strong chance.
I saw one of the websites has a whole list of Jane Does that turned up since Tammy Lynn disappeared that have been ruled out. Did DNA or whatever, and they ruled them out. There's a list of like 20 or 25 of them on one of the websites that I saw.
Mm-hmm. No, sir. I don't know much about this case, but I do plan to do some research. Seems pretty interesting.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, these missing person cases are really, you know, they can get fascinating. And I chose Tammy Lynn to be the first one because of her exceptional beauty. I mean, anybody in America has a soft spot for, you know, a girl that's that beautiful. It is what it is. And 18 years old, she lived such a full life. I mean, she accomplished so much before she was even a legal adult. That, you know, you can't help just be like, wow, what a tremendous You know, when you look at the rise and the fall of like when you're writing a book or when you're writing a screenplay or when you whatever, you have to have the conflict. You have to have the escalation of the conflict, and then you have the crescendo, and then you have the fall. And all, I mean, her life was a novel like that, where the ups and the peaks and the valleys were so extreme and they were so right on. Her high moments were really, really high, and her low moments were really, really low. And right. It's just, you know, for you don't see that usually in a young life that's only 18 when it's extinguished. She really, you know, she went through a lot of stuff like that. And all of that combined with everything else, you know, it really is not a surprise that she snapped.
Quick question. On this Just Gone, are we going to do more episodes and dig deeper into these?
We could. Yeah, if we turn up more, yeah.
Because I think this Wilder dude, man, he's bugging me. Maybe we could get some FOIA. Maybe we could get some FOIA stuff on some of his other cases.
Sure.
Dig into the relationship between him and her mom. And obviously, there's probably nothing to be done with that payphone now at this point. But absolutely right.
Yeah. Like, I can't imagine why you talk about a total failure on law enforcement. Why in the hell would you not pull that and see who if there were any other calls made on that phone? I mean, it's insane. It's insane to me. A lot of these cops make mistakes like this.
Well, maybe they did and we just don't know it.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was saying next. Maybe they did and they didn't like what they saw and they just never released it.
You know, honestly, maybe that has something to do with why her mom took back what she said about him being the killer, you know.
What I found in these investigations, and Matt will testify to this too, as we go through these, we're finding that a lot of these cases have political influence that never, behind the scenes political influence that never made the mainstream news.
As we
investigate them and we dig deeper, we find out that somebody's cousin, somebody's son, somebody's brother that was a high-ranking something that had influence and had money was involved in this some way. And somebody greased some skid somewhere to make it go away. Or to, at the very least, to dull out the involvement of their loved one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we know he made good money. I mean, what was that money going towards? Possibly somebody's campaign or something.
Right,
and this is Florida. Look what the hell Epstein got away with money in Florida.
Oh yeah, there's a history of it anywhere, unless they're looking for it, you know. Especially back then, there was no Patriot Act back in 83. There was no, so you could move money around without worry about anything. They didn't have the $9,000, you know, limit on bank transactions that have to be reported to the IRS. None of that existed in 83.
Right.
That's all stuff that came later.
There's also a record of this is what Tammy's mom said. So it said that after Tammy saw whatever she saw at the party, that she did end up going to the police and made a statement about it. But there's no record of it. So I find that a little bit weird, too.
Oh, yeah. Evidence disappears in all of these cases that we've seen. I would probably say, what, maybe 75-80% of them, Matt, that we've dug into, there's some kind of really important evidence that disappears.
Yep, absolutely.
Right. And
so it's like, well, I mean, they lost D.B. Cooper's cigarette butts, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Like, how do you let that happen?
Yeah, I agree.
Just weird.
So anyway, you don't think in 83 there were cameras at that gas station, do you?
I don't think there were cameras at the gas station, but there were cameras at the bank. There might have been cameras at the gas station, but that was rare in 83. Especially where she was at was not a bad neighborhood. So if it was in like a ghetto, more of a ghetto or a dilapidated neighborhood type scenario, having cameras at the gas station would be much more likely. Also, in the 80s, they were putting cameras in gas stations, but they were putting them on the inside where the places were getting robbed, not necessarily out at the pumps where the telephones were.
Right.
It was never a big deal back then to record the parking lot. It was a big deal to record somebody coming in and sticking a gun in the cashier's face and saying, give me the money. So for years before they put cameras everywhere like they have now, it was inside the store guarding the money there's not really too much to steal in the parking lot of a gas station.
I agree. Yeah, this Christopher guy, just there's just so much tying him to them that it's just, I wouldn't mind diving into it more.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, we could definitely, you know, if this morphs into something where we want to do more investigations on it, whatever the case may be, we can absolutely run with that. Where the show goes is entirely up to our listeners and entirely up to our staff as far as if we want to go deeper into these. You folks listening to this episode, if you're fascinated with Tammy Lynn Leppert case and you think we should go further and you want more episodes and more content on this case, absolutely let us know. That's why we have the chat rooms. That's why we have the website. That's why we have email. You can feel free to contact us through any medium, particularly on our Facebook group, which is facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. That's our Facebook group. Join it. Get involved in the live chats. Talk to us and tell us what you think of the shows, what you like, what you don't like. We want to hear all of it. So for tonight, for my co-host, Danny Lott, for Matt Sloniker, for April Hill, for Ellie Sherrill, for Steph Clark, for Dakota Bloyd, and for Jennifer Falk, I'm your host, Kurt Dillon, saying thank you for listening to this, the first episode of Just Gone. We hope you enjoyed it. Stay tuned. There's going to be a lot more. In the meantime, stay safe. Good night. God bless. And we'll talk to you soon. How to save a life.